I'm a 23-year-old male. I used to work for Airbnb as one of their contracted employees as their tier 1 customer service. For those that don't know, Airbnb is a hospitality service where every day people can rent out their homes and apartments either partially or entirely to people as an alternative to renting a hotel. It's a rather nice idea, although it's in a legal gray area because while there are no laws preventing it, there are no laws guaranteeing your rights as a tenant either, as there is with signing a lease or a home mortgage would grant you. If your host decides to cancel your reservation, your contract is considered null and void in our eyes and you must leave the property, or you can be arrested for trespassing if the host wishes to press charges. I had totaled my car when I hit a patch of black ice in a previous snowstorm, slid into a curb, and snapped my front suspension on the left side of my car, so I was forced to take the light rail to work for the time being. Luckily, I live right next to a light rail station and my work was within 1/4 of a mile from another. I called into the office and told them that I would be late because I had just wrecked my car, and thankfully they understood. I arrived an hour later and my trainer sat me between two girls who had been chatting away in an attempt to get them to quiet down and pay attention. Needless to say, it didn't really work because the girl to my right, Lily, would just lean forward and talk as if I weren't even there. The girl to my left, Amy, would do the same and it was hard to pay attention to the instructor. There was another girl there, Susan, sitting to the right of Lily, who would try to join in on the conversations, but was just not very effective, even though she had the most boisterous voice in the room. I'm pretty sure the two girls were just ignoring her mostly, as her comments seemed forced, and you could tell she had no idea what she was talking about, and just came across as pretentious and rude. During our first break, our conversation returned to relationships. Lily was single, but was crushing on our trainer. Amy was engaged and I was dating a girl whom I had had a crush on since I was 12 and had plans to propose to in the coming months. They both helped me plan out my proposal, things to do and things to avoid, and I'm pretty sure were more excited for me than I was. While we were talking in the front lobby, Susan comes up and hijacks the conversation.
"I have a boyfriend too," she said. "He's 28 and has his own house and drives a Mustang."
For context, Susan is 20 and I'm not judging her for dating someone 8 years older than her, but the more questions we asked, the more it seemed she just made this guy up. Now these weren't malicious questions, but genuine questions trying to get a better idea of who she was dating and just trying to be nice.
"Well, he's not exactly my boyfriend. He's married, but he says he's just waiting on the divorce papers to finalize and then I can move in with him,"
she rattled on. I became more and more uncomfortable with this girl as she started talking about her boyfriend. She would glance over at me, give me a once over, and then continue talking as if nothing happened. It made every hair on my body stand on end. I am a firm believer that there has to be some sort of physical attraction between two people for the relationship to work out, and even if I were single, I was not attracted to this girl in any way, shape, or form. After the end of our training day, I started to make my way to the light rail station. There was about 2 feet of snow on the ground, so Amy offered to give me a ride home as I lived on her way. I greatly appreciated the offer and offered to fill up her gas tank beforehand as payment. Susan jumped in and asked for a ride as well to the light rail station right by my house. Amy offered to drop her off at the light rail station just up the road, but Susan insisted on being dropped off at the one by my place. I didn't think anything of it at first, but I would be lying if I didn't say that it seemed too much of a coincidence that she wanted to be dropped off right at the one right next to my house, where there was another one so much closer. I was dropped off at my leasing office as I didn't want anyone to know exactly where I lived, and my roommate and I decided to order pizza instead of going out in the snow, and I wanted to drown my sorrows in something as I had just lost my car. 45 minutes go by as we wait for the pizza. I understood that it would take a little longer to get here as the weather conditions were terrible and whatnot. The pizza arrives and he hands me something else. A letter, he said, was sitting on our doormat when he arrived. I was intrigued as we had just moved in not more than a month ago and hadn't met any of our neighbors yet, so perhaps it was something from them. I wish I hadn't opened it. It was a letter from Susan. The envelope was covered in hearts and the initials JNS were in one of the hearts with an arrow through it. How did she know what building I lived in, I thought to myself, let alone apartment number. I tore the letter to pieces and threw it away without a second thought.
In hindsight, it was a stupid idea, but I wasn't anticipating what would happen next. The next day at work, Susan approached me and asked,
"Did you get the present I left for you yesterday?"
My only response was, "How did you find out where I lived?"
"I used my admin credentials to access your test listing you created yesterday in training. I hope that's okay,"
she said, trying to act all shy and innocent.
It's not. What is wrong with you? I swear to God, if you ever come to my house again, I won't hesitate to call the cops,"
I shouted back. I was livid. Not only was that a gross invasion of my privacy, she knew I had a girlfriend and had plans to propose soon. 2 weeks went by and Susan would constantly come up while I was talking with Lily and Amy, insert herself into our conversation, and turn them into conversations about her and her boyfriend and all the kinky sex that they have now that the divorce papers were finalized. I'm not one to judge people's fetishes or sex lives, but I really don't care to hear about all the dirty details, especially at work. Not to mention, our conversations were nothing along the lines to begin with. We would talk about relationships, yeah, but the topic of sex never came up. Susan would constantly message me on Google Hangouts, as that is what we used to get in contact with each other on the production floor, as our phones were not allowed because we have access to our users' personal information, the address, last four digits of their credit card or bank account, depending on if they were a host or a guest, so that was our only method of communication while at work. She would send me messages like, "I'm sorry, please forgive me," and, "I just really like you and didn't know how to tell you. Can we just start over?" I would ignore these messages, and I eventually ended up blocking her altogether since the messages became much more aggressive as time went on. "Why don't you like me? It's because I'm fat, isn't it? Why won't you answer me? I'd let you do anything you wanted to me. Just say the word, I'll come over. What's your problem? Any guy would be lucky to have me." And the most disturbing of them all, "I'll just tell them you raped me if you won't let me come over tonight." I blocked her after that and went to HR with my complaints. I told HR about her stalking and using her admin privileges to access my personal information. And at first, nothing happened. I was brushed off and was told the usual, "Oh, it's just a girl crush, she'll get over it." And in a way, you should be flattered. After all, guys can't be the victim of sexual harassment, right? One more month goes by and I was actually promoted to Tier 2. Not really a promotion, they made me go, and I wasn't even getting paid more for the transition, even though it included much more responsibility, such as mediation between hosts and guests involving their disputes. All four of us, Amy, Lily, and Susan, were all put on separate teams, thank God, but she would follow me to the drinking fountain and would just stand behind me, then go sit back down after I left. Wouldn't drink. Just stand. 2 weeks later, I get called into HR's office. I breathe a sigh of relief and think this is finally over. I was wrong. I've been told that Susan has filed charges of sexual assault against me, saying I tried to rape her in the bathroom. I was dumbfounded. I asked them what proof they had, and they said they don't need any, and her word is good enough. After all, why would someone lie about something like that, right? I'd have every reason to try to hide something like that while Susan is brave for coming forward. I tried to leave, but security stopped me at the door. I pushed past them and said, "I know for a fact that these rent-a-cops can't charge me for anything, so until that happens, I'll be at my desk." They let me go and I ran back to my desk, hoping that by blocking Susan on Hangouts, the messages weren't deleted as well. Thank God they weren't. I had been taking screenshots of everything she had sent me over the past 3 months, and two police officers showed up about 10 minutes later. As they were putting handcuffs on me, I shouted at them,
"My computer screen! Look at my computer screen!"
All eyes were on me. The 250 people on the production floor had stopped talking. Most of them put their customers on hold so they could see what was going on. One of the police officers sat down at my desk and started looking over the messages. After what seemed like an eternity, he gets up and says,
"Let him go."
They bring Susan over and the same police officer looks her dead in the face and says,
"I want the truth. Did this guy rape you?"
She nodded her head and the police officer replied,
"Really? So care to explain this message you sent 2 months ago stating that you were going to say he raped you if he didn't let you come over to his house?"
She started crying. tried to say it wasn't true and that I had been the one making sexual advances towards her when she wasn't interested. Thank God the cop wasn't buying it. He said, "Young lady, we have all the evidence we need right here to disprove your claims. However, if you still insist that he raped you, we can investigate. Keep in mind that if it's found out that you were lying, you'll be in a lot more trouble than he is right now." She insisted that I raped her yesterday in the woman's bathroom, so I was officially arrested and brought in for questioning at the police station. They did a rape kit on her, and the cops asked for a DNA sample to compare it to the rape kit sample they took. I, of course, gave it to them and spent the next 2 days in jail. My family was notified, but I informed them that there was no point in spending the money on bail as I knew I was innocent. On the third day, I was released. No charges were being filed against me as Susan admitted that she had made the whole thing up. I was asked if I wanted to press charges for the false accusation and try to get a defamation case against her. I declined and was happy that she had been fired and settled for a restraining order. My girlfriend ended up breaking up with me because of all this, saying that she could never trust me again even though I was found innocent. I guess, on the bright side, I was able to return the ring and put the funds towards a new car. My lease ended a few months later, and I moved across town, got a new job, and pray every day that I never see her again. A few years ago, my partner and I moved from the East Coast to the Pacific Northwest. We didn't know anyone in the city. We just saved up a decent chunk of money and hopped on a plane. It was exciting, and we certainly haven't regretted it. The plan was to stay at hostels and cheap hotels until we could find work in an apartment. Finding work was actually quite easy for us. We had new jobs within a week of getting off the plane. Finding somewhere to live, though, was a nightmare. Everywhere we looked had incredibly steep requirements for credit scores and minimum household income. We tried more legitimate sites at first, but after 2 months of hopping around to different hostels and motels, we became desperate, so we decided to try Airbnb. Many of the listings we tried gave us just as much trouble at first. So one day, I'm desperately scouring Airbnb for temporary rooms, and I come across one that seemed a little weird. The poster said that he had a very large house in a nice neighborhood and that he wanted to rent out a 500 square foot room for $600 and that he would be willing to let us stay there for an entire month, utilities included. In this city, that was suspiciously cheap. He also wrote it in a rambling sort of way. It was almost half an ad for a room and half an open letter to everyone that had recently accused him of being creepy. Now obviously, if we weren't so desperate, we wouldn't have even considered contacting this man. But we thought that we might have been at risk for running out of money before we could get in somewhere at this rate, so we gave him a call. On the phone, he sounded relatively normal. He actually suggested that we meet up with him in a public place to talk about the room first. We agreed to meet him at a restaurant near the hostel we were staying at, though we didn't tell him which one, of course. He showed up late and looked surprised to actually see us there. He sat down and talked for a long time. I say he talked, rather than we talked, because he rambled non-stop about himself and how he felt persecuted by everyone in the city. He claimed to be an artist and a collector. In between him repeating himself many times about how the locals just don't understand his passions, he also told us the room he had advertised was currently filled with his collection. He never once said what he had collected, and that if things went well, he would have to hire people to move it into storage before we could move in. And at one point, he stopped talking abruptly and ran to the restroom. We took this opportunity to discuss the situation. We knew at this point that he was probably a crazy person, but the threat of homelessness was looming, so we agreed that we should at least see the place and decide based on that. He came back to the table sweaty and flustered. We weren't sure why at the time, but we figured it out later. Before we could say anything, he blurted out, "I want to show you the apartment right now." We were surprised by this, but we had just discussed seeing it, so we agreed. I asked him to text me the address and that we would take public transportation to meet him there. He insisted that he drive us there since we didn't have a car. Now, we were obviously hesitant to get in his truck. It was obvious even to him, I think. But the previously mentioned desperation was still a thing, and we were pretty sure he wasn't going to try to hurt us. We were right, but it was still a bad decision in retrospect. so we crammed into the front seat of his tiny, rusty, ancient-looking pickup truck. My partner was pressed up against the door, and I was uncomfortably close to the driver as he continued his babble about how this city had gone downhill, and how everyone he used to hang out with shuns him these days. At one point I whispered to my partner to get ready for a possible tuck-and-roll situation. He saw me whispering but couldn't hear me over the wind roaring through the cab of the truck. One of the windows was broken out, really added to the vehicle's charms, and he said something about how we were romantic together and that he envied our youth. We arrived at his house minutes after. He had been technically honest up to this point. His neighborhood was decent looking, and his home was a pretty large one-story ranch house. I noted out loud that he had bars on all of his windows and several locks on his front door. He said that this collection was very valuable to him and that he was just protecting it from thieves. Once he let us in, I made a point of urging him ahead so that he couldn't get a chance to lock the door behind us. We very quickly noticed three things: his art, his collection, and the smell. This man's method of art, of which he was very proud, was apparently to take lots of innocent childlike things, baby dolls, stuffed animals, ceramic figurines, children's toys, and attach dildos to them. One of the most notable pieces being the one he referred to as his unicorn. It was a ceramic horse figurine that he sloppily sawed the head off of and replaced with a baby doll's head and added a hand-sculpted clay penis as the horn. His collection consisted mainly of rubber, plastic, and latex clothing and gas masks. Both his collection and his art was everywhere. The place was so jam-packed with junk that every room had only a single-file path going through it that you could walk without bumping into art or stepping on piles of fetish wear. This fellow was definitely not concerned about cleanliness. This place reeked of mildew and moldy rubber. The carpet looked as if it hadn't seen a vacuum since the 70s. As we passed through the kitchen, he declared that he loves cast iron pans because you don't have to wash them. Just as we noticed that every countertop was cluttered with rusted pans that all looked to have decades worth of scorched food caked on. We stayed behind him, mostly silent as he stopped every now and then to point out his favorite art pieces and repeatedly tell us he was leading us to the room and that it was full of his favorite stuff right now, but that he'd get people to move it out for us. He said that like us moving in was a sure thing. He opened the door to the room and actually said, "Voila." I don't doubt that the room was around 500 square feet, but every inch of it was stuffed with clothing racks. The clothing racks were all packed with the same thing: shiny rubber, latex, and plastic pairs of pants with dildos sewn to the front of them. Up to this point, we were doing our best to avoid reacting to all the freaky stuff in this guy's home, because we were afraid he would snap on us if we did. But I started to notice after a while, though, that he was getting disappointed that we weren't reacting to anything. My guess is that he gets off on shocking people with his creepy pants, and that this wasn't going as well as he had hoped. We told him that the room looked big enough and that we'd like to go back to our hotel and think it over. He didn't have much of a reaction to that, but he agreed to drive us home. When he thought I wasn't looking, he took something out of his pocket and tossed it through the open doorway of a dark room on his way past it. I was afraid that it might have been his car keys, so I used the light of my phone to peek in as we passed that room. The whole room was a pile of tied-off used condoms, or sperm balloons as my partner called them later. We later speculated that he was masturbating at the restaurant and added a balloon to the pile before taking us back. So we piled into his truck and had a long, awkward drive back to the place we had met. His rambling was much more frustrated this time around, and he passed where we wanted to get out three times before we just jumped out at a red light, frantically shouting, "This is good, thanks so much, good to meet you, go, okay, bye." I added his number to my contacts as Mr. Creepy Pants. Over the next several days, he sent a few texts asking if we'd talked it over yet. I wanted to be polite, so I just said, "We've decided against it, but thank you for the very nice offer." He responded with the phrase, "Are you creeped yet?" copied and pasted over and over about 30 times. I'm not sure why I was still trying to be polite, but when he stopped spamming me, I responded, "No, we thought that your collection was lovely, but it's just so large that we can't bring ourselves to ask you to move it." It took him a few more days to respond, but he did, and he took it better than I expected. "Yeah, I really didn't want to move it, Thanks for understanding. He then made a recommendation for a local burger place for some reason. I blocked his number shortly after that, just to be safe. My sister and I have never been on a holiday together, just the two of us. We went several times with our mom together. My parents are divorced, but my mother was the stressful kind of holiday planner. Cultural tours here, a day-long bus trip there, and back on the plane we are again. So we decided to book a 5-day trip to a place we'd never been to. The both of us never can stand being at a place for more than a week. It just gets boring and we are restless adventurers. We traveled with Airbnb for the first time, and the place was amazing. It was on the top floor of the building with a huge balcony from which you could look down on the intersection till the end of each street. One street led directly to the port. If you followed it down past tennis courts and some parking lots from hotels around a curve. My sister and I always went out for dinner. The seafood was great, and as the days passed, we explored further and further away from our apartment for new restaurants. On the last day, we found a place that served sea urchin, which was about 45 minutes away from home. Greek people are so friendly. When you eat lunch or dinner, dessert is always free, and they set you up with rakı, a very strong, and for me as an inexperienced drinker, painful, little brandy that packs a punch if you finish it quickly. This being the fifth day already, I couldn't stand drinking more than one shot glass, so I left the rest of the small bottle to my sister. She said it would be rude to leave a gift. She can also handle a lot more alcohol than me. We left the place stuffed and with satisfied thirst, walking along the port home to our place. The streets are always full of tourists, but only until the curve I mentioned before. Once you reach the tennis courts, there are about 200 meters upstream to the intersection where our house is. What we didn't expect were that a group of gypsies set up their night camp on the parking lots in the light of the tennis court. If you are not aware of the situation, Greece is overall a landing port for refugees and gypsies, although we didn't see many of them around Heraklion. I felt uneasy because we were the only two girls in the street, besides the group of people getting ready to sleep. My sister was a little happy from the alcohol when I suddenly heard shuffling steps behind me. I could see the shadow of a skinny but tall man. I listened closely to his steps. He was still far enough away from me so that he couldn't suddenly grab me, but I felt very uneasy, as I was wearing high platforms and directing my sister in front of me. He starts picking up the pace, clearly trying to adjust his walking to our pace.
"Hey, hi."
I don't answer him. He comes up to my right.
"Hi."
I size him up. Skinny but muscular. There is something wrong with his leg. His hip seems to be limping. Nope, not the kind of person I'd like to talk to in the middle of the night. My sister asks me,
"Who is that?"
I don't know, keep walking. He passes me and tries to speak to my sister, maybe thinking she would be easier to convince because she looks drunkish. He starts speaking in a foreign language, which we obviously don't speak. She sheepishly tells him,
"What? English. We only speak English."
I run up to my sister and pull her with me onto the street.
"Don't talk to him. Keep moving."
That's when he tries to grab her by the arm and pull her back. I am tense at this moment. With a face of, "Don't you touch my sister," I step up to the guy and shove him with my hands in the chest and shout at him,
"No!"
Because of his limp, he stumbles backwards. I keep looking at him when I take the hand of my sister and walk faster. That's when he starts grinning. Oh, finally we reach the intersection and run into the house. The front door is always open, so I hurriedly get my sister into the elevator and to the third floor. My sister is clearly shaken up from the guy trying to grab her, but rather angry than scared. We lock the door and leave the lights out. From the balcony, we can see the guy walking into the entrance of our house, in and out for at least an hour before he finally left. For a little context, I am currently a senior in college and live off campus with my two best friends. This time of year, particularly around Thanksgiving, my friends try to help me stay busy as it is typically a difficult time for me. My mother left our family the week of Thanksgiving when I was 8 years old, and my dad passed away 5 years ago on November 22nd. So as I said, it's a pretty easy time of year to get myself down in the dumps if I don't stay active. Every year for the last 3 or 4 years, I have gone to one of my friends' houses to celebrate Thanksgiving with their families. But this past year, I decided I wanted to just stay home and have a mellow long weekend. I figured I could catch up on work as well as my schoolwork, which was pretty far behind. My roommates and I didn't live particularly close to the university. We lived in a suburb about 15 to 20 minutes outside of the school. This was nice because we didn't ever have to host any parties. We could just attend them near campus and head back home afterwards. Anyways, there was one house on our street that didn't quite match the others. It wasn't that the house was worse than the others, but it had no landscaping and desperately needed a fresh coat of paint. My roommates and I knew the owner as he introduced himself when we moved in a few years back. His name is Jacob. He's about 5'6" and probably weighed 100 pounds soaking wet. Every time we've had an interaction with him, he was always very nice and polite. He even helped us fix our porch light when it broke last summer. He seems to be very cordial with everyone in the neighborhood and has helped numerous people with small handy jobs similar to the one I just mentioned. On the Wednesday night leading up to Thanksgiving, my two roommates went back to their family's houses in their hometowns. They both asked several times if I was 100% sure I wanted to spend Thanksgiving alone and that I'd be fine by myself. I honestly thought I would be and thought perhaps enough time had passed that I could just focus on other things and not dwell on the past. I stocked up on Mountain Dew so I could stay awake after my assignments to play some PlayStation. At about 9 or 10 p.m., I went up to my room to throw on some sweatpants and grab the blanket for my bed. I glanced out my window and saw Jacob sitting on his front porch with the two porch lights on. I didn't think anything of it and went downstairs into the kitchen and made a peanut butter and fluff sandwich. I would say I was in the kitchen for probably about 5 minutes or so, finishing eating and doing a few dishes. When I finally sat down to play some games, I thought I heard something hit the front bay window, so I went to take a look. At first, I didn't see anything, but then noticed that Jacob had now turned the porch lights off and was standing on his front lawn, staring at the house with his head tilted like he was looking towards the windows upstairs. A little creeped out, I tried calling one of my friends who knew I was still in town to see if she wanted to meet up or stop over to hang out for a little bit. She didn't answer, so I sat on the couch for a couple of moments trying to figure out what to do. He was still standing there staring and seemingly moving a few feet closer to our property each time I looked. I wasn't sure what to do. I couldn't call the cops. He hadn't done anything except freak me out a little, and to this point, he hadn't even stepped on my property. After another few minutes, I looked out the window again and saw Jacob now on our lawn looking at the corner of the house. At least that's what it looked like he was staring at. At this point, I wasn't sure what his intentions were and I didn't want to find out. Perhaps I was blowing this out of proportion, but I was legitimately scared. I grabbed my keys and phone and a few other items, thinking I would just drive to campus. Maybe the library was still open, even though we were off for the holiday. I kept all the lights on so I didn't seem like I was leaving and decided I was going to sneak out the back door. As I quietly sneaked through the yard, I turned the corner to quickly get to my car, and there was Jacob standing in our driveway. I asked him what he was doing in the driveway and he put his finger over his mouth to make a shh noise. I slapped him as hard as I could and made a run for it past my car. My instincts and adrenaline told me to just run until I found someone or someplace else. As I got about a block or two down the road, I saw a bunch of cop cars pull up towards the area of my house. Confused, I began to go back towards my house, thinking perhaps another neighbor saw Jacob stalking outside of my house and called the police. As I approached the house, one of the officers asked my name and if this was my residence. I confirmed the information, and what I heard next is still the most horrifying and disturbing information I had ever received. The officer stated that Jacob reported that he was on his porch when he saw me from across the street. He saw me walk out of my upstairs bedroom, and as I walked away out of the room, he saw a man come out of my closet. Apparently that was why Jacob was looking into my room when I saw him the first time, and also why he was looking at the corner of the house. He was following the intruder who was now walking into my roommate's room. When I last saw him outside my house before I slapped him and ran in terror, Jacob stated that the random guy in my house had made it to the downstairs. Jacob was trying not to make any noise as not to alert the person inside, fearful he could be violent or dangerous. As soon as he saw the man in the house,
Jacob called the authorities and did his best to try and defuse the situation and not bring any alarm to myself or the intruder. The person inside the house was arrested and taken away. He didn't have anything on him other than a knife, so it is unclear if he was attempting to rob the home or was planning something more sinister. Either way, I couldn't express to Jacob how much gratitude I had for what he did. He even tried apologizing for how he handled the situation, stating that there were probably things he could have done differently to make sure I was safe and aware of the situation. Unfortunately, this experience adds another mental scar to this time of year that will take a long time to get over. But one thing I can be sure of is that I will never spend a Thanksgiving holiday alone again.